hard, you can't help but feel absolutely compelled to take action. And that's how we started. We just decided this is not acceptable in our community. And while we may not be able to do everything, we can do something and we can do our part. And that's what got us started down the path.
Has your strategy evolved over the years since you first were inspired to take up this work? Or did you sort of have a game plan from the beginning that you were able to stick with?
Yeah, so we took a giant step back in terms of our efforts because, and this is a good thing, when you learn about this issue, you want to jump in immediately and do a million things, and it's really tempting. But we also recognized that there were other agencies and organizations out there who were already doing really important and significant work. And so instead of duplicating the efforts of other agencies, we went out to learn what they were doing. And so once we were able to piece together the different efforts in our community, we then could take a step back and say, all right, these people are doing this. What's really needed in our community? And for the Junior League, you know, we're a women's volunteer organization. We are not service providers. You know, we're not qualified to work directly with survivors. We are not law enforcement agencies, and we're not, passing laws, right? So we knew that we couldn't do certain things. But what the Junior League is really good at is collaboration, organization, facilitation, and really what we're known for is bringing people together. And that's what kicked off our initial collaboration conference way back in 2012, is we recognized that there were a lot of groups out there, and because it was so early on, not many of them knew of each other or even what they were doing. And so that was our first step, was let's bring everyone together so they can meet each other and learn what's happening, you know, over here across the street even. Our biggest claim to fame, if you will, has been the collaboration piece. You know, when we started the Connect PDX, we've definitely had a hand in bringing folks together community-wide. And we'll talk about, you know, our next initiative and how that ties into the collaboration piece. You know, with our documentary film, that was another effort to bring together the larger, you know, public. And so when my co-chair, Deanna Siebold, really built that film from scratch, that was really her project in 2012, she wanted to put together a piece that focused exclusively in Portland, Oregon. And so the goal was then to use that to bring it as an awareness tool to the larger public. And so while my focus that year was bringing together organizations and groups and nonprofits and service providers to connect them all and figure out really a solution that we could work on together, her focus on that same side was more on the public. So we've always had that collaboration, community engagement first. That's always been our strategy, is how we can bring together people in our community so we can work together.
Could you speak more to PDX Best, your community-wide initiative that engages business leaders?
Yeah, so PDX Best is really still in its infancy, although it's not new at all, which is kind of an interesting dichotomy. So PDX Best started as an awards luncheon to really honor those who have served in anti-trafficking efforts. And it was started by Tom Perez of EPIC Project, and that's EPIK, project.org. And it started in that way, and it was on a smaller scale. And about a year ago, Tom and I sat down. He's been a longtime supporter and partner of the league, and we've got a great relationship with their organization. We sat down and started talking about how can we make this on a larger scale to engage more in our community. As we talked about this, we thought the best way to really bring this issue at a grander scale would be to the business community. And Portland is in a really unique position because we're ahead of the curve when it comes to awareness nationally. And so 10 years ago, you know, not a lot of people were aware of this, but now we are. And so there's a stronger awareness with the public. Organizations have grown, but we feel like the missing piece is the business community. And so the focus of PDX Best, and again, we're still formulating and still working it out, but we hope that in the end of this year, early 2020, the goal will be to engage and personally invite leaders of the business community throughout various sectors. So it could be by industry. So perhaps retail and apparel, fast food, coffee shops, beer and wine, anywhere that sex trafficking could potentially intersect. And we want to invite these leaders of the business community to come and listen to people that really are experts on the subject. And we're so blessed in Portland because we have so many experts who can really speak to this and share the problem with them. Tell them about it. Tell them what's happening, how it's affecting our community. How is it affecting their business, right? And then we don't want to just send them away with this burden, right? That's a heavy burden to carry. And I know that when I first heard about it, I wanted to do something. So we want to offer them ways to engage and really give businesses an opportunity to be the hero. You know, how can they step in? Is it through, can they volunteer in some way? Can they offer in-kind donations? Do they want to support an organization financially? You know, what can they do? So we want to give them a menu of opportunities, ways that they can engage and really stand publicly against sex trafficking in our community.
Who are some of your partners? I know you said it was in the infancy. Are there any businesses that have already stood up to make this pledge?
No, you're one of the first that we're sharing it with publicly. So we are hoping that people will come forward. And I have a gut feeling that PDX Best is going to take off at lightning speed. And people are going to come forward that really want to plug in. It might get bigger than we even hope it will.
So do you have any calls to action that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I'd love to. So right now we are in the throes of our 7th annual Delicates Drive. This is a huge initiative for us every year. We've done it since the inception of our committee and adoption of this issue in the league. And the Delicates Drive is where we collect intimates, undergarments, bras and panties, all shapes, all sizes, all colors, anything at all. And we collect as many as we possibly can. Last year, we collected over 11,000 items. It was a huge banner year for us. And the reason we collect undergarments, a lot of people think, well, why bras and panties? Well, the reason we do is when survivors are rescued or they come forward, unfortunately, a lot of times they have to surrender their undergarments as evidence. And so they are left without these items. And these wonderful supporting agencies who take such good care of them, a lot of times they lack the resources to be able to provide replacement items. And as we all know, these, you know, they're not free and bras cost money and sometimes they're expensive. And so this was something that we heard as a need from our community very, very early on, and we've been doing it ever since. That's why we do it. It's a very personal item, and it's very meaningful. And last year, it was very exciting because when we had the partners, the recipient partners, come to pick up their items, there were literally so many bags of items. Like, we could barely carry them out to their car. And one organization was, you know, in tears, and they were so grateful. And it's such a meaningful, just direct way that you can support this issue. And it's so easy. This year we set up a wish list on both Amazon and Target. Click of a button, you're done. It actually comes right to my home, all these items. We have a huge corner of our home where we've been storing the items. And then on March 2nd, we'll sort them all out and distribute them.
You said earlier that the Junior League really seeks to fill in the gaps of the work that other organizations may be doing. And this is an example of really listening to the survivors of sex trafficking in a way that you might not have known even was needed before. I didn't know about that. And I think a lot of people in Portland may not have known this was a need and really a way to restore dignity and normalcy to women that have gone through traumatic events. Is this the first time this has been done in Portland?
To the best of my knowledge for intimates specifically, and I know there, fully aware that there are significantly more needs than just intimate apparel. That's abundantly obvious. You know, for us, we've stayed focused with this one product type and this one mission consistently over the years, but I'm well aware that there are additional needs. But to your point about that, really is our goal is to fill in the gaps. We see a need, we're trying to fill it, you know, within the junior league. And so just like PDX Best, we're hoping that with that, we can engage the support of our businesses within the community to fill even more gaps. Because if we have more people, you know, on board and a part of this, we'll be able to do even more and leverage that community.
Your organization recently received an award.
So we are incredibly honored and humbled by this award. It means a lot to us. So the Junior League was, we were recently recognized with an award by the Attorney General's Trafficking Intervention Advisory Committee for, and I quote, outstanding service in raising awareness and support of agencies that serve in counter-trafficking efforts. Again, this meant a lot to us within that room. It was on January 11th, National Human Trafficking Awareness Day. And there were so many familiar faces, you know, even from the beginning. Someone said during that award ceremony, you know, my, how times have changed. 10 years ago, you'd walk into a room like this and there might only be a handful of people. And now there was 100. And so that I think was what was most meaningful, was seeing some of those older familiar faces who are still continuing to do the work. We were absolutely honored and we're terribly grateful to have received that award. You know, our goal is just to continue the work that we're doing.
And if people want to donate or learn more about your work, where can they donate?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we would love donations. We're accepting them until March 1st. So you can easily find our donation wish list on jlpdx.org. And if you just look there on the home page, there's a couple options through Target or Amazon. And if anyone has any questions, or if there's a corporation listening or a company that wants to make a corporate or a sizable donation, please feel free to email me directly at stophumantrafficking@jlpdx.org.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
That was Di Bledsoe, chair of the Stop Human Trafficking Committee with the Junior League of Portland, sharing with us what her organization is doing to combat human trafficking. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Emily Gresham Beamer. Now it's time for KBOO poet Dan Raphael's Poetic Justice.
Tax the rich? The rich won't let us, for the moment. Power shifts slowly, but it's shifting our way, seat by seat. You lose some, you win more. Teachers go on strike and get smaller class size and larger paychecks. Airport workers call in sick and end the shutdown. Portland police are coming under more scrutiny. Renters may be getting some protection from the greed of corporate landlords. Tens of thousands wrote the state land board to say, we don't want a frack gas pipeline crossing Oregon. We don't want frack gas shipped from here. We want all gas and oil still in the ground to stay there. Yesterday, a gaggle of bright-chested robins were swooping around our shrubs, finding life in this diminishing winter. The clouds can hide the moon, but can't keep the creative, hopeful energy from leaking through. There are otters in Johnson Creek, local squirrels selling walnut filbert and acorn butter at the farmer's market. I think the new neighbors are salmon. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 20th, 2019. Here are the main points again. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler pushes back against the Portland Police Union, calling for an investigation of text messages to a right-wing group. Residents of Southeast Portland report an increase in attacks and harassment of LGBTQ-identified Portlanders. And teachers in Oakland prepare to go on strike for better wages and working conditions. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emily Gresham Beamer, Dan Raphael, and Jenka Soderberg. And our engineer is David Kesters. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript for this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath
on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Emily Gresham Beamer.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with host Joanne Hardesty. The city's proposed policy on unreinforced masonry buildings, which hits poor families disproportionately, is the topic. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, The Heather McCoy Show features local news and groundbreaking interviews. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman spends the hour with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, whose latest book is the novel Sketchtacy. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by member support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on the button marked Donate.
Listening to KBOO Portland, we'll finish out the hour with some Rising Up with Sonali.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, House Democrats released a new report on Tuesday detailing the Trump administration's plans to push nuclear power plants in Saudi Arabia. The plan, according to a 24-page report by the House Oversight and Reform Committee, involved senior White House officials such as Michael T. Flynn in the early part of the Trump administration. Flynn had apparently worked for the same company that would build the nuclear power plants when he took his job as National Security Advisor at the White House and then continued to promote his former employer. According to the New York Times, Flynn, quote, worked with retired military officers to circumvent the normal policymaking process to promote an export plan that experts worried could spread nuclear weapons technology in the volatile Middle East. A number of other White House officials and Trump associates are also implicated in the plan, including a National Security Council official named Derek Harvey and Trump's inaugural committee chair, Tom Barrack. The Trump administration was, as recently as last week, still hoping to push some sort of plan to build nuclear power plants in Saudi Arabia. The House committee members based their reports on whistleblowers who were concerned, quote, about efforts inside the White House to rush the transfer of highly sensitive U.S. nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia in potential violation of the Atomic Energy Act and without review by Congress as required by law, efforts that may be ongoing to this day. The nuclear plan for Saudi Arabia may explain President Trump's reluctance to strongly rebuke Saudi royals over the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Democrats have said they are launching an inquiry. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday gave his annual address on the state of his nation and said that he would not take first steps to threaten any nation now that the U.S.-Russia Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty was on its way to being nullified. But he did issue a worrying threat, saying that any deployment of intermediate-range missiles in Europe would be met with a targeting of decision-making centers in the United States. According to a Reuters translation of the speech, Putin said, quote, Russia will be forced to create and deploy types of weapons which can be used not only in respect of those territories from which the direct threat to us originates, but also in respect of those territories where the centers of decision-making are located. The New York Times on Tuesday published a lengthy report entitled Intimidation, Pressure, and Humiliation Inside Trump's Two-Year War on the Investigations Encircling Him. The report focuses on how Trump has likely committed crimes of obstruction of justice in his efforts to instill loyalty among those overseeing the special counsel investigation into his 2016 campaign. The report apparently, quote, reveals the extent of an even more sustained, more secretive assault by Mr. Trump on the machinery of federal law enforcement. Interviews with dozens of current and former government officials and others close to Mr. Trump, as well as a review of confidential White House documents, reveal numerous unreported episodes in a two-year drama, end of quote. Among the previously unreported allegations is how Trump asked Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker if a U.S. attorney named Jeffrey S. Berman could be put in charge of the investigation. Berman is a Trump loyalist. On Tuesday, reporters asked Trump about that specific charge, and he denied it.
Did you ask Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker to change the leadership of the investigation into your former personal attorney, Michael Cohen?
No, not at all. I don't know who gave you that. That's more fake news. There's a lot of fake news out there. No, I didn't.
On the same day that the Times released its detailed report on obstruction of justice, reporters published an analysis of nearly all the public statements that the president has ever made on the special counsel's investigation. According to the paper, while it is highly unusual for anyone, let alone the president of the United States, to comment on continuing criminal investigations, Mr. Trump has done so at least once on 330 days, or more than 43% of his time in office, as of February 14th. Trump's friends also seem to think that the strategy of attacking those investigating them is a smart one. Trump's longtime associate and friend Roger Stone, who has been indicted of lying to Congress, has been summoned before a judge after he posted a pointed critique of her on his Instagram account, along with a photo of her face next to what appears to be the crosshairs of a gun. U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson will consider on Thursday whether or not to revoke Stone's bail. Stone apologized for posting the photo and insisted he did not mean to threaten the judge. In other news, National Intelligence Director Dan Coats, who has served in the Trump administration for nearly 2 years, may be the next official on the chopping block. Coats was one of three top intelligence officials who spoke at a congressional hearing last month and whose testimony contradicted the president's claims on North Korea, Iran, and the Islamic State. According to the Washington Post, Trump told one of the paper's sources that Coats was, quote, not loyal, and he's, quote, not on the team. Despite the fact that the White House is facing numerous major lawsuits over Trump's declaration of a national emergency to appropriate funds for his border wall, the president is moving ahead with securing the funds. A senior administration official told CNN that, quote, the White House plans to first draw from the Defense Department's drug interdiction program and the Treasury Department's asset forfeiture funds before moving to divert military construction funds. When reporters asked him on Tuesday if he had the legal right to do it, this is what Trump said.
Very well. We have absolute right to do that. I have an absolute right to call national security. We need strong borders. We have to stop drugs and crime and criminals and human trafficking, and we have to stop all of those things that a strong wall will stop. I could call it a barrier, but I think I don't have to do that so much anymore. We'll call it whatever we want. But the point is that we have to have a stoppage.
That's Trump on Tuesday explaining that he had the right to appropriate funds for his border wall, despite the many lawsuits that his emergency declaration has prompted. The federal government on Tuesday admitted that it has shared its terrorist watch list with more than 1,000 private institutions, such as hospitals and universities. After years of claiming that it never shares the list with private groups, the admission shocked privacy advocates. The Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, is one of the groups suing the government over the use of the watch list. Ghadir Abbas, a CARE lawyer, said to reporters, "We've always suspected there was a private sector dissemination of the terror watch list, but we had no idea the breadth of the dissemination would be so large. There are apparently hundreds of thousands of names on the list. The government's so-called no-fly list is a smaller subset of the watch list." Muslim Americans in particular appear to be targeted by the list and routinely suffer hardships and indignities as a result of likely being on the list. Abbas remarked that the list was ineffective to begin with, calling it a, quote, fool's errand. He added, they're trying to predict among the innocent which people will be terrorists. That's an impossibility. And finally, Senator Bernie Sanders broke fundraising records on his very first day of announcing a new presidential campaign. Within just the first 24 hours, the Sanders campaign raised about $6 million in small donations from more than 200,000 supporters. He has raised significantly more than his Democratic colleagues. And that does it for our headlines today. After the break, we'll re-examine the Trump administration's overt threats against Venezuela and his most recent speech in Miami, Florida. We'll go to Caracas to speak with the political analyst Lucas Kerner, who's with VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Then, as part of our ongoing Black History Month coverage, we'll turn to author Stephanie E. Jones-Rogers to discuss her new book, They Were Her Property, White Women as Slave Owners in the American South. Stay tuned.
KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump traveled to Miami, Florida, and gave a major speech on Venezuela on Monday. During his speech, he addressed Venezuelan immigrants living in the U.S. and exhorted the Venezuelan military to switch its support from the current president, Nicolas Maduro, to opposition leader Juan Guaido. He also gave an ominous-sounding ultimatum, saying, quote, "We seek a peaceful transition of power, but all options are open." Trump cast his speech more broadly as an attack on socialism. In fact, he used the words socialism, socialist, communism, or communist a total of 36 times in 30 minutes. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida announced that U.S. aid would get through into Venezuela one way or another. Rubio told CNN, "I think ultimately the question is whether it gets through in a way that he's cooperative with or in a way that he's not," referring to Maduro. We go now to Caracas, Venezuela, to speak with Lucas Kerner. He is a political analyst and editor at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Welcome to the program, Lucas.
Great to be here.
So what do you make of Trump's speech? There was a lot in there. He very openly linked the Venezuelan exiles, as he calls them, to the organizing of the aid to get into Venezuela, and very openly asked the Venezuelan military to switch sides. He is not making even the slightest attempt to cloak the fact that the U.S. wants regime change in Venezuela.
Yes, I don't think we saw a lot new there on Monday. I mean, certainly, yes, we saw the usual rhetoric with regard to socialism and communism that is, a very thinly veiled effort to score points, political points against the Democrats in the lead up to 2020. But more importantly, we saw that Trump is, calling on, once again, reiterating calls on the Venezuelan military to oust through a coup d'etat the democratically elected president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro. And should that fail, threatening military intervention, that all options remain on the table. So evidently, this is throwing red meat to his base, but at the same time, doubling down on Juan Guaido, the self-proclaimed interim president of the country, a little-known opposition leader who was little-known before January 5th of this year, and who is, I think we're already nearly a month, we'll be a month into this on Saturday, and is no closer to sitting in Miraflores presidential palace.
So let's actually play a clip from Trump speaking on Monday. I want to bring up specifically what role he thinks Venezuelan exiles are going to be playing. This sounds a bit similar to the sort of Cuba playbook, where the U.S. has for years tried to destabilize Cuba using the Cuban community in the U.S. as a convenient tool. Here is Trump on Monday speaking about Venezuela.
And I want to especially thank the Venezuelan exile community that has done so much to support President Guaido, to organize aid for their compatriots, and to do just a lot back home. Thank you very much for being here.
And that is President Trump on Monday, part of the speech that he gave on Venezuela in Miami. A lot of the Venezuelan immigrants to the U.S. were present. Lucas, how exactly is he using Venezuelan immigrants to the United States? He's basically admitted very clearly that it was this community that helped organize the aid to their compatriots back home. But of course, the aid is a thinly veiled pretext for some sort of U.S. intervention, right?
Yeah, I don't think that the Venezuelan community in the United States is at all involved in this effort. Rather, it is, you know, as we saw on Saturday, it is being carried out completely by the U.S. military and U.S. military jets, which on Saturday landed this so-called humanitarian aid in Cúcuta, just 8 kilometers from the Venezuelan border. And really, we have to understand that the International Red Cross, the United Nations, Oxfam, and numerous other international humanitarian bodies have criticized in no uncertain terms this aid effort as politicized, as, you know, an effort to use aid as a instrument for toppling a government which the United States doesn't like, which, you know, of course, is a violation of all of the principles that govern the distribution of humanitarian aid. And moreover, we shouldn't forget that it is Mr. Elliot Abrams who, in the Reagan administration, was key in channeling U.S. weapons, using humanitarian planes earmarked for humanitarian purposes to channel weapons to the Contra paramilitaries in Nicaragua, you know, during the United States' illegal war there. And also, of course, he was supplying weapons to the death squads in El Salvador and Guatemala as well. And he is now resurrected as the U.S. envoy to Venezuela now. So we should be very wary of the U.S. effort to bring this so-called aid to Venezuela and violate